Ciao a tutti, sono Alessio Boceda, sono il co-founder di Startup Geeks e vi do il benvenuto a una nuova puntata del nostro podcast. Cosa facciamo con Startup Geeks? Vogliamo formare la nuova generazione di imprenditori e lo facciamo principalmente tramite una community online in cui oltre 1.000 persone si confrontano ogni giorno sulle tematiche più delicate del fare impresa e tramite un incubatore online chiamato Startup Builder, con cui abbiamo già supportato più di 500 team nel testare il potenziale della propria idea e lanciarla sul mercato. In agosto del 2022 abbiamo deciso, io e la mia co-founder Giulia D'Amato, di andare a San Francisco e in Silicon Valley per scoprire l'ecosistema startup locale e poi raccontarlo a coloro che sono in Italia. Abbiamo parlato con imprenditori, con manager, con investitori e con esperti del mondo dell'innovazione e delle startup e in particolare in questo podcast potete ascoltare l'intervista fatta a Steve Blank. L'abbiamo incontrato nel suo bellissimo ranch a Pescadero, a circa un'ora di macchina da San Francisco, e Steve è uno dei massimi esperti del mondo startup e quindi gli abbiamo fatto un'intervista molto diversa dal solito e dedicata esclusivamente all'ecosistema startup italiano. Vi dirò di più su Steve Blank, è professore a Stanford ed è stato descritto come il padre del modo moderno di fare impresa. Ha una exit importante alle sue spalle, è stato coinvolto in varie startup e soprattutto, diciamo, dopo essere andato, tra virgolette, in pensione, ha lanciato il movimento Lean Startup, con cui ha drasticamente modificato come le startup vengono proprio lanciate e come l'imprenditorialità viene insegnata. Inoltre, con altre sue iniziative, ha anche drasticamente ammodernato come le aziende e i governi innovano. Steve è anche l'autore del libro Four Steps to the Epiphany e anche del libro The Startup Owner's Manual, con cui appunto trasmette i suoi concetti e le sue metodologie con cui appunto ha rivoluzionato il modo in cui le startup vengono create. E la sua cover story sull'Harvard Business Review ha ridefinito come le grandi aziende invece possono innovare rapidamente. In questa intervista parleremo di diventare imprenditori, di lanciare il proprio business, di cosa lui suggerisce di fare a chi sta pensando di diventare un imprenditore, di come gestisce e di come gestire il salto dal lavoro da dipendente a imprenditore. Parleremo anche di fallimento, della cultura del fallimento e poi di successo e delle caratteristiche più comuni che lui ha rilevato nei founder di successo. Non perderti poi l'ultimo messaggio che Steve ha voluto mandare apposta a chi ci ascolta dall'Italia. Invece, se preferisci leggere l'intervista in italiano invece che ascoltarla in inglese, sul nostro sito troverai anche una trascrizione completa in lingua italiana. Speriamo che possa essere utile. Non mi resta che augurarti buon ascolto.
Steve Blank, we are really, really honored to be here with you today and to have the opportunity to bring your voice to the Italian startup community. You are one of the most experienced and influential people in the startup world. You shaped how we launch startups in these days, and today we would like to ask you some questions, which are mainly about three topics that are very relevant to anyone who wants to create their own business. Let's start from the first one, which is starting a business. As we all know, starting a business is hard, and therefore we would like to ask you if is there anything you really recommend people to do before starting to work on their own startup?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is to understand what's a startup. At least here in the United States, a startup can mean multiple things. When we start talking about the tech world, we get very narrowly focused. But and what goes with what's a startup, it's also what's a founder, right? In the U.S., a startup could be someone who has a what we call a lifestyle business. They have some other profession out here. I live on the coast of California. I have lots of friends who are surfers, but to make money, they teach surfing lessons. And so they're an entrepreneur, they have a startup, they're a founder, but their focus is not to grow that into a international surfing school. They are working to live. There's another class of founder which makes up most of the businesses in the United States, and those are small business founders and entrepreneurs and startups. And they run everything from restaurants to grocery stores to database marketing to web design. Those are also founders and startups. But a couple of things that are interesting here that differentiates those folks with the from the technical world is number one, their businesses will never be large enough to attract what we call risk capital. That is, they might get loans from friends and family or banks or sometimes, depending on your country, the government, but they can't scale to be worth hundreds of billions of dollars. And therefore, they can't attract angel or certainly can't attract venture capital, not because they're not smart or whatever, but the businesses can't return that. The second consequence of small businesses is they're not magnets or attractors from the best and the brightest across the world. You typically hire friends or folks from the local community to build small businesses. And I want to emphasize, there's nothing wrong about being a small business entrepreneur. The mistake, though, I see lots of people make is confusing that with what I call a scalable startup. And a scalable startup is a startup that you have an idea that could generate, you know, value in billions of US dollars or euros. And that requires, you know, ideas that are large, that requires seed capital and then risk capital for investment in multiple areas, and sometimes requires lots of people past your friends, family, or even your local university or city, that requires lots of people to get hired. Does that make sense for first describing that? And now I forgot what your question was.
If there is anything that you really recommend to these people who wants to...
So launch. One is to understand what kind of startup are you doing. And again, it's not that you can't go from a lifestyle business to a small business to a scalable startup or something else, or work inside a large company and be an entrepreneur. But you ought to not mistake which one you're in, because that's what confuses folks. And I call that an impedance mismatch problem. That is, you think you're one thing, but the people who are investing think you're another, and you get frustrated of, oh, I have this good idea that could generate a million euros a year. Well, that's great for you, but that's not even like worth talking about for a venture capital firm. Does that make sense at all?
Absolutely. Right?
So number one is to understand that. Number two is, and again, I see a lot of folks around universities, students mostly, thinking that now entrepreneurship is cool, or within your group it's cool, and it's a thing to do and it'd be a great job. And that's a major mistake, because being a founder of a company, and even the first employees, it's the world's worst job. There is no worse job in the world than that. But it's the best calling. And this distinction between a job and a calling is the distinction between an artist and some other profession. You know, if we understand artists, particularly in Italy, right? Artists see things that other people don't, or they hear things that other people don't. And in fact, on day one, they're the only people who see that vision, but they attract other people to go work with them, and they attract the resources to make that happen. That's the exact description of founders. Founders are closer to artists than any other profession. And if you're not called to be an artist, then don't think of yourself as a founder of a company. You might be better suited as an employee. Because the other thing to think about, the analogy of artists, most paintings or most music are terrible, right? You throw them away, or no one likes them or whatever. And so you go through this cycle of massive disappointment, but you constantly build new things. And by the way, as an artist, because you fail at one painting, you're not considered a failure. You're considered an artist. In fact, people expect that you're in a hits-based business. That is, maybe one out of 50 things or 100 things you do will reach the top of the charts or sell a million copies, or people will be playing in another 20 years. That's exactly how you should think about founding a startup and entrepreneurship.
And do you think it's possible to learn how to become an artist, an entrepreneur in this case?
Well, so that's a great question. So the question is, did Michelangelo or Da Vinci have innate talent that, regardless of who they would have apprenticed with, they still would have painted the Sistine Chapel or the Mona Lisa? Or, in fact, was it the fact that they worked with masters and apprenticed for decades and picked up some of those styles? So I believe a couple of things. So to answer your question, I keep using the artist analogy because founders, not employees, but founders, are probably closer to that than anything else. So I believe we could probably train 90% of folks about the basics of what it takes to start a company. How does the money work? You know, what about team building? What's product market fit? There's now methodologies for this. But there are a few people who have natural talents. And again, I'll talk about the Da Vinci's and the Leonardo's, is that, yes, you could have put them through apprenticeship, but they were probably a small core. I mean, you know, Mozart was playing piano with three, right? You have to admit that there is some innate wiring for different skill sets. And is there Is there some innate wiring for how to be social and how to create reality distortion fields? A reality distortion field is, how do you convince people to quit good jobs and join you? How do you convince customers to pay you money for when all you have is a PowerPoint deck? Or how do you convince investors to give a 20-year-old, you know, like $10 million? Happens in Silicon Valley all the time. And so it's not only the idea, it's how do you present the idea? What's what we use, the phrase that came from, popularized by Steve Jobs, reality distortion field. That is, how do we create a vision that's not exactly there, but you could kind of see it once we explain it. Those are skills that, those storytelling skills, if you watch Masters, you could kind of see, like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could ever do that. But over time, you can get good at it. But some people are natural storytellers or artists. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So I just gave you a business school answer, which is, it depends.
Yeah.
The engineering answer is yes or no. The business school answer is,
absolutely.
Well, it depends.
Absolutely. And we're getting in touch with many aspiring founders. And many of them tell us that they have multiple ideas. They have a small paper book in which they write down all the ideas that they get, but sometimes they are not able to decide on which one they want to focus their life and their next years of their life on. Do you have any recommendations about people who have multiple ideas in terms of...
Yeah, go get a real job.
Go get a real job.
Yeah, because you're not a founder. So the founders are the one who pick an idea. And what are the phrases, burn the boats on the beach. You know, this story about Cortez when he landed on Mexico, landed on the shores of obviously what would become Mexico, and his people wanted to go back, and he burned the boats so no one could go back. This is the emotional problem that founders who have really not decided to be founders have run into. They haven't committed to something. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with sketching, but get a real job until, in fact, there's something you can't get out of your head. It's an itch you need to scratch. That's different from, I'm thinking about some itches. You know, it has to be something that you're passionately want to bring to fruition, that you have where others see a blank canvas, or the Michelangelo thing, people see a 12-foot block of marble, and you know, the story was when his friend saw that and he said, it's the most beautiful sculpture in the world. And I said, it's a 12-foot block of marble. He said, come back in 3 years. And there was the Pieta. And when they said, how'd you do that? He said, well, I just removed the stone around it, right? That's, in fact, what drives founders, not I have a bunch of ideas. Your dog probably has a bunch of ideas. It's the ability to, and the passion to drive to that vision of, I want to see this built and in people's hands and whatever. I think a lot of young entrepreneurs confuse, I have a lot of ideas, with actually being a founder of a startup, which is, no, I don't care how many ideas you have. Which one are you gonna take and make it happen? And the make it happen part is not like drinking coffee in a cafe on the street with your friends for, you know, 6 weeks talking about it. It's making it happen.
And I think this answer also relates with one of the fears that often come out in Italy, which are the fear of telling other people about their ideas, because we have the fear that someone steals our idea.
Yeah, unless you're designing nuclear weapons, that's really not a problem. You know, 99% of, I'm going to say that this is true for everything except for life sciences, biotech. If you have a life science idea, then you need a patent attorney first before you even leave your bedroom. But for every other idea, it isn't about the idea, it's about the execution of the idea. And in fact, the more you keep it secret, it's more, I don't really think you understand what it takes to be an entrepreneur, because it usually takes multiple iterations of talking to potential customers and regulators and suppliers and investors and whatever, that you're going to be doing a lot of pivots and MVPs and whatever, minimum viable products. Your idea, almost no one's idea is born fully formed and executable. And so it's really an image. Honestly, now that I've gotten older, it's really kind of a naive, in a polite way to say it, and maybe a little cruder, immature way to view about what the role of a founder is and the value of an idea. The idea is valueless unless you built a team and have kind of matured it by getting lots of feedback outside the building.
Absolutely, thank you. And also, some people are blocked because they want to start, but they are alone, and they have the fear of doing the entrepreneurial path alone, maybe without any kind of co-founders. Do you think it's better in this case to start doing something and then look for someone in the way, or just stop in the beginning and look for someone who can share all the steps?
So most startups, I mean, and there are multiple exceptions, are started by teams. And the team usually at its core has an innovator and an entrepreneur. And the innovator is the someone with either the technical idea or the insight or knows something about regulatory environment or something special. But the entrepreneur is someone who knows how to go through walls, who to create this reality distortion field. If you want to know the examples, Jobs and Wozniak. Wozniak was the innovator, but he'd still be living in his mother's basement without Jobs. And Jobs would still be a master of bullshit without having someone who could actually build a product. Or Gates and Allen. You know, Paul Allen actually, you know, wrote DOS, or actually stole it from Seattle Silicon. But in any case, was the engineer. But Gates was the, or even when you look at Tesla, everybody hears about Elon Musk, but Musk didn't design or build the drive chassis or the batteries or whatever. That was J.B. Straubel. So there was an innovator and there was an entrepreneur, SpaceX. It was Merlin who built the Merlin engines on the Falcon 9 or the whole Falcon series. Musk was the, I mean, Mueller would still be some nerd looking for a job with Rocketdyne or somebody, but Musk was the one who raised billions of dollars. Does that make sense? So if you start looking at those companies, you start realizing almost all of them had a visible Mr. Outside that was the outgoing entrepreneur, but the co-founder, or at least co-founders, were the people who provided the technical chops. You know, it's not always the case, but it's a pretty good pattern to go, oh, that's why they talk about teams and complementary skills. So it's okay, in at least my mind, if you have the idea, whether or you could be the innovator or the entrepreneur. And the first one, probably another thing for you to decide is, who are you? You know, in my case, I was always the entrepreneur, dangerous enough to understand the technology, but in no case too dangerous to actually design anything. But I got to kind of understood what my partners were explaining. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so the point to your question is, sure, you could start having the idea yourself on either side, but it's better to see if you could attract your complementary partner. And that's also a test of your ability to recruit later. If you can't recruit a complementary partner or a co-founder, I'm not sure you're gonna be a good founder. Doesn't mean you couldn't be a good early employer, can't learn it, but it's the first test.
Got it, thanks. And the customer development that you invented and described outlines a clear path to launching a tech startup. As there are many people that still do the first steps while having a full-time job to be able to pay the rent, until which step, in your opinion, it's possible to launch a startup without quitting their own job to go full-time?
Well, so, you know, I used to believe that the first step, which was customer discovery, getting out of the building and talking to people to validate a series of hypotheses, which is, by the way, a very fancy Stanford term for guessing. You know, you're just sunk in guessing on most of your ideas. By the way, what are you guessing about? Guessing who are the customers. And you're guessing about, oh, what features of that product you kind of thought they wanted. And by the way, that combination between who are the customers and the features is called product market fit. So you're doing discovery about that. Implicitly, by the way, you're doing discovery about you think you're solving a problem or fulfilling a need. Ooh, well, how do I know that? Well, I believe so. I'm the founder. And therefore, you believe the solution you came up with will fit that need. Ooh, well, why? Well, because I invented the thing. I've been coding for 6 months. Or I designed this website. You know, of course they'll love it. All those things I used to believe you needed to do 100% in person. Now, after COVID, when we went all remote, I believe all your first meetings should be online. Not because they're better meetings, but you could do 10x in the time you have, and you could do it, you know, on your coffee break in your existing job. So I believe you could validate a set of hypotheses, a set of guesses about the core things about commercialization. That is, how do I turn my idea into a profitable company by simply saying, well, which hypotheses do I want to test? The biggest mistake, by the way, in doing that, even if you were still holding a job, is saying, oh, I need to test whether people want to buy it. And if that's what you're thinking, you've gone way off track at step one. You missed the first 10 steps, and I just explained them. Well, what problem or need do you think you're solving? Why don't you just ask people, do you have this problem? Oh, okay, well, I validated that. Well, you know, like, what are the top 10 features? No, they're the features I have. No, not what you want to build. What do they think of the top? And then, well, how do you want to buy it? Oh, I'm going to put it on the App Store. No, how did they want to buy it? Because you might want to be charging 99 cents, and it might be a piece of enterprise software that might be selling for tens of thousands of dollars. So my point is, you could do a lot of this. Just don't think that the first thing I need to test is whether people want or like my product.
Yeah.
That's called selling. It's a big idea. That's not customer discovery or validation or lean methodology. That's sales. And you think you could shortcut all that, is skip all those first steps. I have very, very rarely seen someone get it. In fact, I've never seen someone get it 100% right without going through those initial steps. And usually for a first-time entrepreneur, they ignore all this advice, try to sell the product, and then realize they need a methodology.
This is interesting, because sometimes we have people asking, yeah, but I understand the validation, because of course we talk a lot about customer development and validation, but what happens if I just don't do the first steps of validation? Well,
So the odds are that you'll be standing there going, well, I'm out of money, or I built the wrong product or whatever. So no one is going to stop you from doing that. In fact, the natural instinct of a great founder is to get out and sell. That is the natural DNA. So don't feel bad if you want to do that. That's what I wanted to do. And it's just time and again, the passion of what you think is a block to actually learning. You stop listening and you end up talking a lot, when in fact your first phase should be shut up and just listen. Just ask questions first to make sure you understand what it is that you think you're solving. You know, one of the core parts of lean methodology is customer development process, which says there are no facts inside the building, so get the heck outside. But the corollary to that is the reason why is, you are the smartest person in your building, but there is no way you could be smarter than the collective intelligence of potential customers. That's why you're getting out, right? It's not only there are no facts, but the facts are actually out there, and there's a lot of them. And if you're just talking, you're like, hard to hear. So no one is going to stop you from doing that. In fact, sometimes for my first-time entrepreneurs, I say, listen, go humor me. I know you've built the first MVP, and you want to go sell it and whatever. Just go out and talk to 10 people. Don't show them the product, and ask them if they have the problem you think you're solving. And they come back and go, well, they don't get it. Well, you think they'd give you any money if they don't get it? Well, we'll convince them. Boy, that's a long, hard sell.
That's sometimes a problem.
Right.
Wonderful. And still related to working while having a current job, do you think there is a perfect moment to quit the job and go full-time on the startup?
Well, you know, it gets harder as you have a family or obligations or parents to support or whatever. So number one is I'd make sure you have enough resources, meaning money mostly, places to sleep or whatever, you know, somebody's bedroom or cot or, you know, whatever. And that you've set kind of a time for yourself about how long you're going to go do this. And that if you have a relationship with a spouse or a wife or someone else or husband, that they understand that they're not going to see you. I mean, you might physically be there, but you're going to come home late, or if you're working from remotely, you're going to be working 14-hour days and whatever, and they ought to understand the commitment you're about to make. And then finally, the best time to start a company is like when they say the best time to plant some trees. It was 20 years ago. That was the first best time. The second best time is now. Because you don't get the time back. And you know, one of the things I learned early that every couple of years I have to rethink about is, you know, we don't get to do this again. So this isn't practice for some other, maybe it is, but we're not going to know about it. This is it. And so I tended to live my life without ever wanting to say I could have, I should have, I, you know, whatever. Now, I understand some people have other constraints and commitments and whatever, but they shouldn't be their own constraint.
Wonderful. Now, a very difficult question, maybe, or maybe very easy. What is the hardest thing about being an entrepreneur?
Well, that nothing ever goes per plan. That it's complete chaos and uncertainty and whatever. And then depending on who you are, if you're technical, learning about relationships a lot, about team building, about working with co-founders, about working under stress, about getting turned down a lot. I mean, getting turned down a lot is a, you know, is probably the common theme of entrepreneurs. You get turned down by investors, you get turned down by customers, you get turned down by people you're trying to hire. You know, it's like, you know, it could be pretty depressing. Again, it's the life of an artist, right? And by the way, the other hardest part is you fail most of the time. You know, not everything you build works, and you're, you know, running MVPs and you're doing pivots, which is a key invention about lean, which allows you to not think of it as failing, but think of it as learning and discovery, a continuous loop of learning and discovery. But that's still hard. And then, like most of the time, most startups fail. They don't turn into Facebook and Google, like 90% of them. Like, and being able to pick yourself up from that, both personally, emotionally, and then it depends on the culture and the ecosystem you're in. You know, in the U.S., in Silicon Valley in particular, we have a special word in English for a failed entrepreneur. Do you know what it is?
No.
Experienced. Right? Now, in any other culture or any other innovation that doesn't have an innovation cluster, you know, if you fail, you've shamed your family or your community or your neighborhood or whatever, and then, you know, gosh, you know, and then your parents are asking, why did you do this? And you could have had a good job in a big company or for the government or a bank or whatever. But it's exactly like them asking you is, why did you become an artist, right? The pay is terrible and, like, you know, we don't really like your art or your plays or whatever you're writing. It's the same thing. But one of the key differences is you know, you're in an innovation cluster. When people understand that entrepreneurship is all about rapid learning and discovery, and that means most things don't work. And you pivot and you change, and so most of the time it goes on inside of a company. But when eventually you run out of money, the company fails, and then most entrepreneurs get depressed for 2 weeks and then start their next one. And if you want to see a company that embraces this on a large scale, SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's rocket company, has one half of the company that has operational excellence of launching 5 or 6 rockets a month from 3 different launch pads across the United States. But they have another half, which is inventing the next generation, which is blowing things up constantly on their test pads. And Elon says 2 things. One is, if we're not blowing things up, we're not pushing hard enough. But number 2 is, if we're not blowing them up on a regular basis, we're not operating at the right tempo, speed and tempo. So it's not only embracing failure, it's actually operating at speed and tempo. And that model is the model of startups. But if you don't have a culture or an innovation cluster culture or a national culture or a business culture that embraces startups as an integral part of what an economy should have, then you have a pretty stagnant economy, and yeah, people don't move forward, or you end up buying your products from the U.S. or China, where instead, you know, every country should have their own innovation ecosystem that's just kind of an adjunct or an integral adjunct to the existing economy. And you know, both the government could support it not only for money, but also by changing culture and by small changes in bankruptcy law, tax law, etc. But the biggest thing is culture. In a lot of countries, people mistake, you know, entrepreneurs who fail with, like, big bankruptcies of big corporations where someone embezzled money or just did something stupid, rather than understanding that these small startups are in fact the things that make innovative new things. And that's why other countries are inventing them. And, you know, of all the places in Europe that, like, I think are the most inventive, I mean, who invented the Renaissance, for God's sake? It was Italians. You have artifacts all around you about what a great innovative culture and country it was. You just need to remind yourself what that was
like.
Yeah,
absolutely. We need to learn how to implement that kind of thinking into the tech mindset and ecosystem, and it's a very important topic in Italy. I don't think we still have a right culture of failure, as you described.
But I also think it's a right culture of educating the populace about the distinction between startup failure and fiat going out of business, or whoever big fail, or embezzlement or whatever, is that one, you want to put people in jail, and the other, you want to encourage. But if you don't explain the distinction between the two, then just saying we want people to encourage entrepreneurship just misses the point that 99.9% of the populace can't differentiate them, because we as entrepreneurs haven't done the work, and neither has the government helped us in just simple education. That doesn't require a lot of money or funding. That just requires, oh, now I understand the difference. How come we're not doing a lot of that? Now give these people a lot of money. But if you don't explain it, then people think, why am I giving money to these folks? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I hope we can work on that very much.
Well,
very much.
You're already doing it with this interview.
And let's go on the other side of the coin, which is success. Everyone can define success in their own words. So for this question, let's just define success as the situation in which a team has built a profitable, scalable, replicable business, as you define a tech startup. What are the most common traits or characteristics that you see of successful startup founders, if any?
Well, so let's remember there's a difference between success in building a repeatable and scalable business, and difference between success in doing that and success in making a lot of money. Sometimes they're not even aligned. So in a bubble, when the people are handing out bags of money on the corner of the street, which was here in Silicon Valley in 2021 and maybe 2020, the goal wasn't necessarily to build profitable, scalable companies. The goal was to, in fact, get to what's called a liquidity event, that is, to be able to sell all of your company or part of it to another investor. And that, you know, that's kind of a scheme, right? You got to remind yourself that the goal of a founder and the founding team is sometimes not the goal of the investors. The goal of the investors is to make the most money in the shortest possible time. The goal of the founders might be to change the world or to deliver a world-changing product, etc. For most of the time, they're aligned, meaning they work in concert. But a lot of the times that the investors, you know, they don't dislike the founder or dislike the area that they're investing in, but the investors are attuned to the state of the financial markets, right? Can I make money out of this investment at this point in time more than in investing in any other place or any time? And so what I remind founders is that the minute you take money from someone, their business model now becomes yours, which is a big idea. If you can't explain to me how your investor is making money, then you're going to be like disappointed a little later on, or sometimes be the ex-CEO. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so success might be, you know, you've shipped, you know, a million copies of a piece of software, or you've saved lives by building a piece of hardware. But success also might be that you just made, you know, $100 million and you're retired sitting like at home. Or your investors made, you know, or you were able to sell some stock on a next round and you have enough now to be almost life-changing, even though the company hasn't been profitable. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And is there any characteristic for this kind of founders? Let's just focus really on creating something
So this is just me, and there, you know, there's a couple of founder traits you hear all about, right? They're agile, they're relentless, they're tenacious. I also would add, at least me and others I've seen as well, are intensely curious about a lot of things, not just their domain. They have good pattern recognition skills. That is, they could see some things that others can't, and they see where to go. They absorb enormous amounts of data and are able to make rapid decisions. So good enough decision making, where, you know, in a company it might take you 10 weeks to schedule the conference room. In the meantime, a startup has shipped the product. I mean, you know, so and as I said, the reality distortion field, they're able to recruit at least some part of the recruiting team. So those are kind of pretty known characteristics, I think, of what it doesn't guarantee success. But if you're not relentless, or part of your founding team isn't relentless, and by relentless I mean you got your eye on the prize and everything is just an obstacle to remove. Ooh, that was me, right? Tenacious, that means you're gonna stick to it. You know, like your co-founder just quit and your best customer just, you know, changed their mind and the bathroom is leaking and whatever. I'm you know, all right, I'm still on it. Resilient, another word, which means even if you fail in that company, you know, you'll spend a couple of weeks feeling sad for yourself and then you're gonna get up and do another one. It's what makes serial entrepreneurs, those who do multiple things. So there are a set of common characteristics that that are kind of shared that are a little different from what I'll call normal people. The other one is operates well in chaos and uncertainty. If you need to know what you're going to do when you come to work in the morning and you need to know what time you're going home and you've got a family that expects you at dinner at 5:02, this is the wrong job. But if you're happy, you know, and you would in fact thrive on that uncertainty and you figure out how to make your way through it, that's another skill set. So there, we could probably make a pretty good skill set. And as you remember, that doesn't necessarily need to be in one individual, but it does need to be in the founding team. Those set of characteristics need to be there, or else you've diminished the odds. It doesn't mean you can't get lucky or can't whatever, but the odds increase if you have those skill sets.
Absolutely.
Oh, and the last one is, and founders are impatient. You know, my first rule is founders don't stand in line. You know, like lines are for other people. You know, it's like rules are for other people, right? You want to see rules for other people? Elon Musk, even if he wasn't the richest guy in the world, was still a jerk. I mean, you know, and I mean that in a nice way, that, you know, founders are annoying people if they're good. And I don't mean they can't be nice, but they're driven in a different way than most people are wired. And what's really interesting is, of course, that type has been with us for thousands of years. It's just that in the last 50, this intersection of capital, that is money, that's willing to risk them at fund them at scale, is what's made this Cambrian explosion of innovation, is this combination of this personality type, this vision, and this capital. It's Florence and Venice at, you know, 500 years ago with all the money they had. Right?
Wonderful, wonderful. Steve, we have one last question for you. It's a very open one. What would be your last message to the Italian startup community that will listen to this interview podcast?
Well, what a beautiful place to do. Invite me. I'm happy to, like, come teach there. So we had wonderful times in Italy. Seriously, I mean, you know, think about it. Silicon Valley doesn't have smarter people than Italy. I mean, what we have are a culture willing to embrace the fact that, you know, failure is just, I mean, imagine playing football where all you had was one shot on the goal, right? I mean, like, think about that. That would be both a boring game and the score would be one every time. 1-0, that would be the score. So I think in Italy, it's literally not that they're not great entrepreneurs, that you guys need to step back a bit and think about how do we educate the populace who we are, why we're important, and connect to the history of the Renaissance in Italy, that we were the Renaissance and we could, you know, this is Renaissance too if you just allow us to do that.
Wonderful. Steve, thank you so much for this wonderful interview and insights. We believe they will be very precious and useful for the one who wants to launch a startup, and we also believe that still every day many people and more people will be willing to take this path to innovate and to change the life of the future generation. So thank you so much and all the best.
Well, thanks for having me.
Speriamo che questa intervista ti sia piaciuta e ti abbia dato molti spunti di riflessione. Se ti interessano le tematiche come innovazione, startup e creazione di un proprio business, continua a seguirci sui canali social di Startup Geeks e sul nostro sito www.startupgeeks.it. A presto!